This is Clive Pearson, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 2nd of May 2012. Clive Pearson, Part 2. Most of the scientific work was to do with the geophysical experimentation, wasn't it? So were they were searching the skies, were they, looking for...
Well, the thing was, they had this Dobson spectrophotometer up in the roof space, and they would set this up and plot their discs from plot their discs from the readings that they got. And I've reasoned to believe, and I don't think I'm talking out the back of my head, but Joe, with along with others, were the first to more or less prove that there was a hole in the ozone layer.
But that was 25 years later.
Yeah, but the thing is that they were showing that there were thin places in the ozone layer, and because of the nature of the recordings that they were making.
Even in 1959? 58?
58, yeah.
So there were hints then, were there, that there was problems ahead?
That they knew that there was thin places in the ozone layer, because if they took readings under certain conditions, you know, they didn't get X, Y, and Z, but if they took them under other positions, that they did show a major difference in what was happening.
Was this being discussed on the base at the time?
Well, it was known, but I wouldn't say it was discussed, because the thing was that the work that Joe and David were doing was quite a bit removed from the weathermen, you see. Now, the weathermen were principally interested in... There was four of them who was definitely sond, and the other fellas was just weather. Now, Jeff Rowe, for instance, he would only do weather, but he was a geologist, but he did weather as well. Whereas you had Brian Giles and Martin Smith and Bud Shaw and whoever, who did sond as well. And they would work that up at 8 o'clock in the morning and 8 o'clock at night, whenever they did flights. And then if it was a clear day, they would fly balloons to do winds, etc. And so they had theirs to discuss. There probably was some discussion of each other's work, but I don't think there was any open discussion. If you asked questions, everybody was prepared to answer them.
So when the news began to break in 1985 about the discovery of the ozone hole, it was no big surprise to you?
Oh, no, not to us, no. Certainly not to me, anyway. I think, well, I could have told you that before, but I'm not going to say not that I was allowed to or anything, but I thought, yeah, well, anyway, we had reasons to believe this, you know, back then, like, you know.
Did you see phenomena such as aurora australis?
See, the aurora australis, it was rather splendid on one particular occasion. Mario Nantes, who was Uruguayan, who'd been posted down from Stanley Met, and he did the year before me, came back to England my first year, then came back on the base for his second year, well, that was second year. And he could speak reasonable English, you see, and he was on Night Met one particular occasion. And we're there, you know, tucked up, and it's outside, it's minus Lord knows what, beautiful clear night. And he came in the bedroom, all very anxious, you know. It's Brian. Brian was senior Met, Brian John. Brian, it's Aurora, it's Aurora. Yeah, what's that, Jack? It's Aurora. And of course, we all came out, trousers on, jackets on. But yes, it was quite something.
Yeah. Can you describe it?
Well, it was pretty much like you've been fortunate enough to see in a lot of documentaries of late. It's like beautiful green and purple and sort of blush red curtains that that just sort of very gently move in the upper atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And it's quite thought-provoking, actually. It's quite beautiful. It makes you realise that there possibly is somebody else out there other than ourselves. Like, you know.
Were you religious at all when you went out there?
Well, I've been brought up in the church, and I've been an altar boy since I was nine. and I missed my church while I was out there, although I was saying my prayers at night the same as possibly others did, but religion, as far as we're concerned, is a rather private thing, not that you're afraid to admit it. And, I do believe in things like that, very much so. Yeah.
One or two FIDs have said that they've sensed God much more closely in the end.
Oh, very much so, yes. When God created the world, he created that first. Yes, that's one of the things that I've thought about, especially when I've been down there by myself and looked out over and said, but, it really is. You've actually got to go down there and experience to realise.
Some of his better work, is it?
Oh, it's phenomenal. It really is. Yeah, it gets you.
Touches
you
in the heart. Yeah. Things have changed, haven't they, in more recent years? The FIDs today, are they the same as they were in your day?
I personally don't feel they are. I'm prepared to stand a wrath of what I'm going to say, but persons who go south now go south with intentions of studying a particular line of business, be it upper atmosphere or ice or one thing or another. And fair enough, they do go out on the ice. They've got these wonderful machines now where you can do more in an hour than we would do in a fortnight, or maybe even more. You can, sort of get on a skidoo and do 40 mile an hour. And at the end of an hour, it'll probably take you a week or maybe even more to do anything like that, back with dogs and sledges, etc. More power to their elbow as far as that's concerned. But I think that because they have all these things and they haven't known any different, their attitude towards south is infinitely different. And whereas we went down there with awe and wonder, and we're mentally prepared and physically prepared to take on what the gods may throw at us and respect it in the process, they go down there and they do what they've got to do. But the thing is that they're able to do what they need to do in infinitely shorter periods of time because of what's available to them. And those that are down there to do specific scientific studies are able to do them in proper bona fide workshops, offices and stores, which is really little more than working away from home, because now they've got facilities to fly them down and fly them back. So really, we do respect the people who are doing that sort of work, but I think that the original south side of things is a thing of the past.
Was that beginning to change in your time?
Yeah, well, I personally, I noticed as I went down there and I didn't know anything different. And I don't know what the attitude of the people from whom I took over, what their attitude was towards me. But I took it over in good faith and I tried to replicate what I had been shown and found out had worked by my predecessors. And the persons who came with me, they only knew what I did, even though they perhaps have had a couple of days with someone else doing it for them. But they were prepared to accept that as the fact that we were in transit. And we had a rather splendid two-year period together. And we all respected each other for what we did and how we did it. But when the people came in to take over from us, they came in and just took over. And we went away on the ship for a couple of days and came back and I went ashore. And it was a completely different setup. They'd physically altered the kitchen. They'd done modifications in the kitchen. And they'd done things which we hadn't done because they were suffering from what we knew would happen had they done what they had done. And it was been interesting to go down and find out how they overcame what situation they created.
You mean they were making basic mistakes?
Yeah. They cut a hole in the floor and mounted a washbowl over it with a waste fitting in it to do the washing up rather than carry it outside and pour it down the chute. Of course, the thing was, because it never had a trap on it, the wind used to blow back up and it used to blow bubbles in the sink. Because not all the space under the hut was all empty, where the wind that blew in underneath could always leak away. So you only got to get a bit, which was sort of just like a hollow. And because there was a great artificial hillside of tins of flour stacked up on one side of the hut. Well, that would trap the wind there. And this would cause the, you know, just a minute difference in air pressure. And this would blow it up through.
But were there other subtle changes taking place that you thought you were at the very end of one era and another era was beginning under your noses, so to speak?
That was the main thing, was that I noticed that their way of, their whole way of working was infinitely different than ours.
Can you give another example of how different it was, please?
Not really, because the thing was that I just only focused in and around the galley, and they made changes there, and that just stuck with me. I know I found out since that they later altered the bedroom and made it up into smaller rooms, but sort of, whether there was just not individual beds, but they made it up infinitely different than a bunkhouse. They made it up into sort of like two or three rooms. And also there were more fellas on the trip that we left. There was 12 from South against them, 12 or even more. But as far as how they reworked the rest of the hut, I can't honestly vouch for that.
But nevertheless, you sensed you were at the end of an era.
Yes, I personally sensed this, yeah.
Did you feel connected to the heroic age, the Scott and Shackleton period?
I feel that we were, the people who came up to the end of us, i.e. 1960, up to them, we were the last of the old school. This is what I personally feel. Because after that, then, everything got so advanced so fast. As I say, we still had the Bisco, and she went down and did whatever she did, and what other associate vessels went down with her. But also the attitude of the people was changing so quickly. And also the conditions under which they were working were changing as well. The nature of what they were doing was also different. And the equipment they had to work with was changing.
More sophisticated.
More sophisticated, very much so, yeah. And of course you got transistorized stuff coming in where... And stuff like, you know, when we got back to Montevideo, everybody was on about 3D, not 3D, stereo sound and surround sound and all this. Of course, we'd never heard of this or anything about it. And there was things like that were creeping in. And of course, this was vogue to the lads who were coming down. And we just had to fight our way into that, whereas they were taking this down with them.
It was the beginning of the swinging 60s, wasn't it?
Very much so, yeah.
And the other thing that was changing was the ability to communicate.
Well, that was changing as well. We were still Morse, because I don't think that changed until for quite some time. I can't vouch when it changed, but it obviously did. But it was Morse under favourable conditions, because if you had bad weather... You know, you were in Funny Street until such times as the weather changed. And especially the period we were down there, that was another interesting period, you see. We were down there during the International Quiet Period, which ties up with the sunspots.
Yeah.
That was part of the reason why IGY was established when it was, because it was the bottom end of the 11-year cycle. And you get sunspot activities, as they've found out to their cost recently with all these solar flares and such like. You know, you get something like that, it's... The old Morse key don't work with that sort of activity, or not to any great extent anyway.
But I was thinking also the ability to communicate with headquarters. In your day, you were left alone because you really couldn't consult headquarters.
No.
The base leader was fairly autonomous, wasn't he?
Well, that was, yes. Yeah, that was, yeah.
But that was also beginning to change at the beginning of the 60s, surely.
Well, I can't vouch for that.
No, okay. But it was all part of the process of modernisation.
Yeah. As I say, you know, I just knew Joe Farman for the first year and Keith Bell for the second year. And we were, we were a happy band of pilgrims.
You came back home on the Kiss the Dan, didn't you?
Yes.
Which had had a very interesting voyage south, hadn't it? It had been a besetting, quite a substantial...
Well, I was on it when that happened.
You were on it?
Yeah, very much so.
That was when the plane was damaged, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What's your story?
Well, the plane was on Kiss the Dan, on the after deck, and the Bisco, and they were both in McMeek Channel in Argentine Islands. And they were both swinging around either because of the wind or because of the tide. But anyway, the Bisco got a bit close to Kiss the Dan, and it just touched the end of the wing, did some minor damage. I think Mr. Bates, who was one of the RAF chaps there, I think he probably must have done something about it, because later on, when we did sail, we still had the aircraft on board. And when we got out, we were out to leave, and we were going to head south. And we got into some ice and we felt our way along and felt our way along and felt our way along. And the beauty of Kiss the Dan was that you could drive the vessel from the crow's nest, and the skipper would be up there with his searchlight and his joystick. And he felt us along and felt us along and did what he could. And then we got to this part where there was a bit of open water. So we stopped the vessel, and they lifted the aircraft off and put it in the water. And one of the RAF pilots taxied it out, took off, had a fly around, radioed back. There's some good leads, X, Y, Z, so and so and something else. And I can't honestly remember whether we brought the aircraft back on board and actually started moving, or whether we stayed where we are, or what happened. But anyway, we've got the aircraft back on board all right. And the next thing we knew, the wind had changed, and we were back in the ice again. And I don't know whether it was on that occasion or very shortly afterwards that the ice moved in, and we were lifted up like a cherry pip and leaning to starboard. That's right, leaning to starboard. That's right. About such and such. If you look at the front of the Illustrated London News, have you seen the Illustrated London News photograph on the front of the air? Right. And, of course, that was great. So they dug a hole in an iceberg next to us and put a hose into it to take water as it melted with the sun for the generator. And, of course, needless to say, we was out on the ice doing our things, taking the photographs, you know, standing by the ship, you know, usual gubbins. And jolly parties evenings. And one thing or another, we had Vivian Fuchs and Mr. Stevenson with us, you see. And they'd been down base hopping and one thing or another. And, of course, we were just there for the sake of being there. And we'd been there a couple of days. I think we were there for quite a few days. I'm looking at the diary and checking up. But anyway, there for quite a few days anyway. So Vivian got a bit peed off with our late night activities, you see. So we called us all to order and says, look, the novelty's worn off. Can you sort of cool things down a bit? So anyhow, we behaved ourselves a night. We behaved ourselves for two nights. And then we must have slipped. So he came up and he admonished us again. So right, slap wrist. So we admonished. Right. But anyway, the next thing we knew was he closed the bar. So we thought, So anyway, I don't know how long we suffered it, because several of us had stashes, you know, disguised as...
private supplies.
Yeah, well, you're sure you got a lemonade bottle, you know, with about half a teaspoon full of orange squash in it, like, you know, best part of a bottle of booze sort of business, you see. And there was several of these about 20, we couldn't stretch them anyway. We went capping down to Cervivian. Well, he wants Cervivian, and he was just... Anyway, we went capping down. I said, right, but behave yourselves. Anyway, in the meantime, we were still fine and dry. So they put out a shout for the San Martin, which was the RG icebreaker. And they said, no, you can't have that because they're in the same state as you are. So the biggest icebreaker the biggest icebreaker ever was the Lenin, and she's up in the Arctic. There was nuclear. So they went capping on to the Americans. And the biggest in the free world was the glacier. So they came down, and the first thing they did, they went once around us to take the pressure off. And she had 10 engines, but she was only running on 7. And once they got the pressure off, she streaked away, hoping that we could follow. But the thrust of her screws was such that we was just going back with the brash. So she'd roar ahead for a bit and make a load of mush, and then we'll feel our way up to it. And they couldn't tow us because we never had anything that was man enough for them to tow us. And the cable they had wouldn't go through our hawse pipe. So we said, well, we'll put a turn around your mast, you know. So anyhow, they mushed it up and we followed them, and they mushed it up and we followed them until we got out to the border, and then she just toot-toot and she legged it, which you can't blame the people, like you say. And then we felt our way out of there and we went up to Deception. And any stores we had, we unloaded in what was left of the whale station. And they'd cut the side out of one of the old storage tanks, and we just stacked everything that we had on board in there. And they lifted off the aircraft, and it had ski wheels on it, and they dragged that up the beach, and then that spent its time there. Because they later built hangars on Deception. And then I don't know whether we went to any other bases when we left there, but we ended up back in Stanley, and we had a little run around in Stanley, whatever the case may be, and we went from Stanley up to Monty, and we had a day or so in Monty, and then we potted on from there and got back about mid-May, I think, about the 8th or 9th of May, something like that.
Were you sorry to leave the Antarctic?
Well, very much so, yeah.
But your 2 years were up, were they?
Well, very much so, yeah. And I did apply. I applied. I can't remember. It was 12 months or 2 years. Anyway, I asked if I could go back again or apply for a job back down again. And for reasons best known, they found it best not to re-employ me. I don't know what the reasons were. I had all sorts of wonderful mental pictures of whether I'd done something wrong or said something out of place or something, or for reasons, but there was no reason why. And yet some of the other fellas, you know, they have 2 or 3 trips or maybe even more, like, you know. But I don't know what the reason why they felt that they no longer wanted to employ me.
So you're back in Dartmouth unemployed?
Well, I'm back in Dartmouth, yes, and I'd only been back a few days and they were just in the throes of finishing off building a boat hell, which is the same as a motel, but this is for boats. And this had been created during the whole of the time I'd been away on the site which had once been Dartmouth Gaslight and Coke Company. And I'm out on the waterfront of Dartmouth with my father's motorboat cutting in the boot top, you know, the coloured line around the waterline. And a young woman who was in school with me came up and said, good afternoon, Clive. And I said, good afternoon. So she said, we've just coming up to starting our new hotel. She's been wondering if you'd like to come and work for us. So I said, well, I'll come down and give it a look. So I went down and we went in and I met the management. And he said, would you be at all interested in being chef? So I said, yes. So we said, right. He said, wages. So we picked up a copy of Hotel and Caterer and had a look, and he said, here we are, no, no, domestic staff, so and so and so. £8.12. See? £8.12, that was the rate. See? So quick as a flash, he says, we'll pay you £9. Because immediately you accept over the rate, you're at their beck and call, you see. So I said, yeah, fair enough, then. So, right, So she wrote, "We start X, Y, Z, so and so and so on." So of course that meant to say that I had to be there for the grandy opening ceremony. So myself and another lady and a couple of others did this buffet for the opening. And because it was a boat hell, they decided to open it like you were launching a ship. Now the mayor at the time was going to open it. And they thought, well, how can we break a bottle of champagne over the front steps without making a mess? So somebody with a little bit of upstairs says, we'll put the bottle in a sea boot sock. So they put the bottle in a sea boot sock and hung it by a ribbon from the front of the hotel. And the mayor says, I know, now this place open. Whop, and broke it on the front steps. And it all fizzed out through the sock and ran down the steps. And just to prove it was champagne, he went over and squeezed the toe of the damn thing and tasted it just to prove that it was champers. We haven't put a bottle of fizzy water in it or something like this. Anyway, we were away. And I did all of the season in the hotel bit. That's evening meals and casual meals and all the rest of it. And we come around the end of the season and they had two huge barges out in the river where you could pull your boat up or moor it to and park up, and you could come ashore either for hotel facilities or bed and breakfast facilities or just use the restaurant and bar. And come around the end of the season, I didn't particularly fancy doing restaurant. So I said, with due respect, I think we'll call it square. So I said, we're sorry to lose your club. I said, well, you know, much not like you, but don't fancy it anymore. So I said, right, so anyway, so I packed in that. Much as ever packed it in, and I was pounced upon to go and work in a hotel in Torquay because the chef had a nasty accident and he was out there running. So I went up there and got them out of trouble for about a couple of weeks, I think, something like that. And came back to Dartmouth, and it was coming into December then. So I got a job on the post office. And then very early in January, I'm walking out the prom. No, that's the second year. So I went down and I got a job with the firm that was building the boat hotel. And I went to work with them as a labourer. And they realised that it was a bit more than sawdust upstairs. So they asked me, lots of comments about why you're on the buildings, you know, when you've had your footing in the catering, like you say. So anyway, they gave me an excavator to drive. So I went taking out footings and one thing and another. And we did some roofing and one thing and another. Anyway, I got through all of 1961 with them. And they went bankrupt because wifey thought that if there's money in the till, I can spend it. And there wasn't any money in the till because they hadn't paid the bills. So consequently, they went bump. So I was out on my ear. And of course, I registered out of work. And I'm walking out the prom just after. I went on the post office for the Christmas, which you could do. 5 and 6 pence an hour. And I'm walking out the prom. And I meet the man from the Dole office. And he says, seen you before, words to the effect of. I said, yeah. He says, you know, have you made any attempt to farm? I said, yes, I'm just going out to see about something now. May the Lord forgive me, you see. So I knew there was only one place I could go if I kept walking. And that was another building company, you see. So I went out and I went round to the office and said, are you taking on? So he says, what? I says, general assistant. So we said, yes, start Monday, bottom of the row. So I said, right. So anyway, I went with them and I did all of 62 with them and in the 63. And I got a job doing acoustic lagging, where you lag the walls and the floors and stairs of blocks of flats so you don't get transmission of sound. I got God doing that. And I was getting on a treat with this. Worked out a routine and life was good. And where there was passages in the floors, you cover it with sand and put pitch on it or some soluble material and warm it in with a lamp and then put the acre tiles on it. And the propane machine blew up and I went up with it. So when I came out of hospital, I didn't fancy going back on the buildings. So I asked if I could go on the maintenance at the Naval College, where I'd been cook before I went south. And I went back on the maintenance up there. And that went round until 67. And I was in my element, absolutely in my element. And now, any mechanics, et cetera, on building sites, et cetera, it's referred to as plant. And a notice had come up on the notice board. They wanted a static plant operator for Cyprus. Hello. So they said, there's a notice something they want to see. So I penciled my name in the margin. And I carried on. We were doing a job in a swimming pool. There's a telephone call for you up the office. So I went up and he says, office here, Clive. I said, yeah. He says, would you like 12 months unaccompanied ascension on it?
Well, in fact, you did 3 years there in the end, didn't you?
In the end, yeah.
We can't go through your whole career, but no. The point I want to make is you've worked in some interesting places, such as Ascension Island. And is it Ghana?
Gan. It's the last island south of the Maldive chain. And it's 65 miles south of the equator.
Gosh. So you've done some travelling in your life?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah. In all that, how highly does the Antarctic rate?
Oh, top of the list, isn't it?
Is it?
Oh, yeah, it's still very high on the list, yeah. Yeah, as far as for, nearest and dearest, it was a very happy period of my life, which I shall cherish, but with no disrespect to South, but I had a truly wonderful time in Ascension as well. I was really, really at home there as well. And then I had that period out in Gan, which was another, it's supposed to have been 12 months, got called up the office, got a slap wrist, got told off, and instead of only having 5 months to do, they gave me a new contract, so I ended up doing 19 months instead of 12.
You've been back to the Antarctic?
Yeah, I went down in 2005, and that was quite interesting, that.
On the Marguerite Bay 2005 trip?
Yes, very much so, yeah.
What differences did you spot?
Well, mainly some of which I've related, in as much as it, the attitude of the few people that we met, in as much as they gave me the impression that they were there doing the job, and they didn't seem to have the same attitude towards it as what our lads seem to have had. They were there doing the job, and they were probably doing the job on a par, or probably even better, with due respect, to what our lads were doing.
I was thinking, though, about the environment and how the Antarctic had changed.
Oh, yes, because tremendous, yeah. Lots and lots of ice gone, yeah. Especially when I went back to Base F, back to the Argentine Island Group. We couldn't get in up through McMeet Channel or in the other way because of brash and that. So they took us in through and dropped us off at Wordy. And we climbed up the back of Wordy and had a look over onto to Winter Island. And it had physically changed in as much as the hut is gone, and they've got a new plastic temple there now, and they've got a bulk storage tank. I think the only thing that I can remember was the balloon shed was still there, and one or two other bits and pieces, which was quite, and also what had been an ice cliff opposite Wordy, that was gone, and now the angle of the back end of Winter Island was infinitely shallower, and the area around the lead into Wordy House, that was infinitely wider, and what had been the ice cliff had all gone.
So you were seeing the consequences of your suspicions of 45 years previously, weren't you?
Yeah. You know, all this wastage, tremendous, yeah. Of course, the lads who were with us, who'd been sledging further down, you know, they said, good Lord, yeah, you know, this used to be from here to there, solid sort of business, and that used to be from X to X, you know, to half a day's march to get up there, whereas now you can Yes, I tried to find that, yeah.
So how did you feel about that trip in the end? Were you glad you went or disappointed at how things had
changed? I was glad I went, but the thing was that I wasn't really at ease in my personal physical self, because some kind person or persons unknown on the vessel that we were on had left a bug, and a lot of us got this bug and we were just lethargic, which was most unfortunate. And also we had some particularly good weather going down the southern ocean as well. But not that that was by the board, that. But, yeah, it was great in as much as that I've been down there and had another look, you know, sort of to put my mind at rest. But it was a disappointment in other ways, yeah. But I'd still like to take the wife back down here just to, because it's her arch desire to see penguins in the real. Yeah.
Not Paignton Zoo.
No.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Clive. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Happy with that.